I next have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Steve Sanderson. He's our president and CEO of the Wildlife Conservation Society. Prior to that, he was dean of Emory College's Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Emory University in Atlanta. He got his PhD in political science just a couple years ago, right? Yeah. His accomplishments include a Ford Foundation program officer in Brazil. He directed the Tropical Conservation and Development Program and was chair of the Department of Political Sciences at the University of Florida. Fulbright scholar, as well as numerous scholarly publications, including a 2002 publication in Foreign Affairs entitled The Future of Conservation, which I would recommend to anyone who's interested in understanding the complexities of the issues that we deal with. Dr. Sanderson.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Barry, for that generous welcome. I want to be brief because it's important for the deliberations to begin, and I'm looking forward to being a consumer of the meeting today. And just a couple of notes about the origin of this conference and our role in it. The midwives of this meeting are really progress and frustration and urgency and hope. And there's been a great deal of progress in our scientific understanding of the connection between wildlife health, domestic animal husbandry, and human health in a context of accelerating globalization. And at the same time, there's been a great deal of frustration in that scientific progress and our understanding of the phenomena out there in the world have not been linked to sound public policy in a variety of areas. There has been a great deal that's been done positively, but in the recent outbreaks, we have not seen, for example, a linkage between the public health policy of many countries and the conservation principles that we espouse toward the treatment of important and vanishing wildlife populations. Nor have we seen such great and important phenomena as West Nile or sudden oak death linked to profound changes in animal and plant trade. So there's some frustration there. It's a matter of increasing urgency, and one only needs to read the New York Times in the morning to find finally that these issues are of great national news importance. And to see the outbreaks of emerging infectious diseases and their connections to wild and domestic animal populations and the fears that people have, including a piece in the Times this morning that links the current avian flu problem in Southeast Asia and the likelihood of a connection between human-to-human transmission to the great flu pandemic of 1918-1919. Those kinds of news treatments of a subject like this speak to the urgency of our issues today. And the theme of this meeting is not one of despair and darkness, but one of hope. Because we genuinely hope that we can be a source, a wellspring, as scientists, conservationists, public policymakers, and citizens, a wellspring of progressive change in public policy and something more profound, which is a linkage between wild animal and domestic animal well-being and human health, a concept, a global concept of health that encompasses animals and humans and speaks to a vision of human life that includes wild animals, wild nature, human sustenance, and a positive vision of well-being that we perhaps lack at this time. It's been well known in history that there is a strong connection between wildlife health and human health, and certainly as people have domesticated animals and increasingly intensified the use of domestic animals and agricultural systems, the connection between wild animal populations and human health has grown more intense and more global. The rinderpest problem is a very interesting one because it's been around for 250 years, and we were speaking about an outbreak in East Africa in the 1990s, in the mid-1990s, that threatened some of the great ungulates that provide not only wonderful examples of wildlife on the hoof, but great economic benefit for Kenya and Tanzania. So these are not just aesthetic and cultural risks. These are profound economic risks. And we all know the cost to the Asian economies of the outbreaks of SARS and hoof and mouth and other diseases. We bring a unique take to this because we're worried about the conservation of wild animals. And so West Nile is not only of importance because it's now in all of the contiguous states of the United States, and speaks to issues of the global transmission of diseases, but it's also important because it threatens important and rare bird populations, including possibly whooping crane and others, and it threatens to move to the tropics where bird biodiversity is really at risk. And so that's a concern of ours that gives us, I think, a unique angle. The other angle, which perhaps goes unstated, is that we, in our concern for the connection between wildlife health and domestic animals and human populations, we work among the very, very poor in this world who are extraordinarily vulnerable to these diseases and the relationship between wildlife and their own health. If you think of Chagas disease in the Bolivian Chaco, for example, where we work in the Isoseño Indian communities, or if you think of leishmaniasis in the Amazon or elsewhere, hantavirus in the American Southwest, the Ebola outbreaks or tsetse or rinderpest, these are all diseases that afflict the most vulnerable to the greatest extent, and these are the people who have the least in the way of a clinical response available to them. So when we see the populations we work with in Bolivia, and Bob Cook and I went there a couple of years ago to look at our projects, and really all of the people who live in those communities, and they are remnant communities of Guarani populations, so they're extraordinarily valuable culturally. All of them are vulnerable to Chagas disease. And to go through the various countries in which we work and see the vulnerability to pneumococcal and other diseases, or to see the disease outbreaks in Southeast Asia and where they have their greatest incidence in the populations, so they're most vulnerable. And quite often those populations are attacked in public policy rather than supported. And we see a perverse public policy response. And I remember last year it provoked Billy Karish to help me write an op-ed on the SARS outbreak, because what we saw in the New York Times were Chinese public policy officials drowning civets in lab coats. The civets weren't in lab coats, the Chinese officials were. This is not a public health policy, it's animal cruelty. And it certainly did not speak to the necessary response to SARS. Likewise, when American bison step foot off of the national park system and are shot because of the premise that they might spread brucellosis to domestic animal herds, or when guanaco in Bolivia and Chile come too near domestic animal populations and are shot because it's expected that they are creating greater vulnerabilities in domestic herds to certain kinds of diseases, when in fact the evidence that we have indicates that the connection is the other way around. When wild dogs are shot in southern Africa because of threats of distemper, and in fact they're being decimated by contact with domestic animals that have not been vaccinated against distemper. This goes back 40, 50 and more years. The first studies that we conducted in the Serengeti of Serengeti lions and their behavior showed vulnerability to distemper. And now 40 years later, those populations are still at risk from domestic animal connected distemper and so forth. So I hope that in the course of the deliberations of the day and what we can do in the way of moving forward from here, that we will look toward a human health idea that is a conservationist idea. And we will look toward a program of activities globally that speaks to the problem of wild animals as food, as one of the leading agents of Ebola outbreaks and SARS and many other infectious diseases, and that we'll look at the pet trade or the ornamental plant trade, and we'll look at public policy practices and quarantines and sensitivities toward human populations and wildlife populations that will put us in a better place as we consider the connection between humans, domestic animals, and wildlife, and as we move toward a concept that is both ambitious and exciting of one world, one health. So I prematurely congratulate the organizers of this conference because I anticipate it's going to be a great day and a very rich agenda. And I thank you all for coming and wish us all well during the day and the years to come in this great quest. Thank you.